when we come together on a Thursday night, I hope you feel it's a celebration. Everybody brings an invisible bottle of wine, which is your heart. And we all get a little bit intoxicated. Compared to other nights. And I hope you feel that pleasure. Tonight we began with some Sufi healing music that has its roots centuries ago, both in Central Asia and in Ottoman Sufi practices. And we were present for this recording. In fact, we produced the recording over 20 years ago, I don't remember exactly. And listening to music like this is a little bit like having something wash over you and wash your hearts. It really is a kind of therapy or healing. Musicians themselves are people of a very high state. And in fact, are the revivers of this tradition after it was dormant for some centuries. And this particular mode, or maqam as it's called, is called rast, which means sort of straight, and it's a little bit like the major scale, and it's just a good, positive, joyful sound. I hope you felt that, and you also felt, sense the water flowing. Actually, water is also an instrument in Central Asian shamanism, and this music also draws on those Central Asian sources. I remember we had to get the water to the right temperature because water of different temperatures have different sounds. You may not know that, but can't be too cool, can't be too hot, it has to be slightly lukewarm to have the right sound. So I thought we would give you that gift tonight and without you having to do anything but listen. But hopefully you were listening. Hopefully we know how to listen. It can't be assumed that we do. If we were just here kind of sort of listening and thinking about our day and thinking about other things, you know, that's nominally listening and it's really not sort of receiving what the music and what the moment can offer. So I intentionally didn't offer any instructions so that I could wait until it was over and then explain what you should have been doing. What you might have been doing. Let's leave out the word should. Yes. It's not really part of our vocabulary. Really, it isn't. But I assume that all of you are well trained and well disciplined in the receptivity of the mind and some mastery of attention. But ideally, we could sit with this music the way we would sit in God's presence. Not that this music is God, but that this music carries that intention, and music carries that state. The people who are playing it for no other reason than to worship, really. To worship and bring a positive energy, healing energy and vibration into the world and share it with all of us. That's the intention behind it. So if we could simply bring our presence to this and be undistracted and just listen without much commentary, without imposing your own story on it, without running your old tapes, you know, whatever those tapes may be, or old recordings. Conditionings, habits of mind. We drop all of that. Simply to be here, to be open to this, to be open to our own breath, and through the breath to meet this healing music. And doing that together, our vibrations sort of accumulate and magnify each other, and a beautiful state is possible. So that's what we were doing, inshallah. And it's what we always do. It's how we live. It's the practice of presence and remembrance. We learn to sit when we can simply devote our full attention to being present to the Divine Presence. We appreciate that possibility. And it arises in our lives more than we think. Even in many of our routine activities, this could be the state. Sometimes even in some complex activities, we might find a way to do this. Admittedly, when we're doing complex mental activities, we need to focus our mind and our reason and our intelligence on that. But even the ability to do that is also an aspect of presence. Presence can be foundational to that. So these two things support each other. The practice of presence, the practice of learning how to quiet the mind and still the emotions, can actually contribute to clarity of our reason, clarity of our thought processes, and also even the possibility of finding solutions to complex problems through means other than the drudgery of analytical thinking. The analytical thinking is good. It's good for a foundation. It's good to sort of get all of your issues there in front of you and all of the, you know, all parts of the equation and just know what it is. But then to really find a solution may come from another direction. So tonight, I thought it would be interesting to share some basic reflections on the Sufi process, what it is we do and how we do it. So what I did was I excerpted a little bit from a chapter in the Knowing Heart. And I'll just pass those around. Just one page, two-sided. You don't really have to read it, but you can if you like, and if you can see it. It's in the paragraphs preceding this section, I was writing about the role of the sheikh being comparable to a conductor of an orchestra. Some people with all kinds of ideas about what a sheikh is or isn't. And while this doesn't exactly explain it all, I think it's a pretty good metaphor. Because what the sheikh does in Sufism is bring together an orchestra of individuals who are each playing their instrument, playing their part. And the sheikh is not the best musician. Sheikh is just a conductor who knows the repertoire, who knows the tradition of the music, so to speak, who knows there are these such and such symphonies and so forth by such and such composers, and has the role of harmonizing the different parts. And meanwhile, the people in the orchestra, it's their responsibility, for one thing, to be really good with their instrument. That's sort of taken for granted, a pre-qualification. But I was reflecting too on the idea of a really important idea in Sufism called rabita, which means invisible bond and resonance among us, between the sheikh and the murids, they would be called seekers. And how, I was asking myself, does a conductor have that? And I realized, yes, of course. The conductor must also have that kind of relationship with the musicians in the symphony, because while obviously the musicians are not going to be just automatons playing, you know, the notes on the page, they have to bring their hearts to it, their attention to the music, but also the conductor is adding something. The conductor is adding an emotional element, you could say even a spiritual element, an overview, a kind of transcending awareness, an awareness of the whole, and has a sense of what the potential of the music is. What the music, let's say, I mean, just to be aim high, let's think of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, something like that, which has those great words by Schiller, which are all about freedom, liberation. A conductor, to adequately do Beethoven's Ninth, would have to have a real beautiful sense of what Beethoven was intending, and perhaps even bring something unique to the situation. So the musicians too have to bring their hearts to it, but obviously the musicians are not just all doing their own thing, like, well, I have an opinion about Beethoven's Ninth, I don't care what the conductor thinks, I'm just going to do my... No, it doesn't work that way. There has to be both a very beautiful individual attention and individual quality in each of the musicians, including a heart quality, but also there's a unity, there's a harmony, there's a resonance. And that's when something quite extraordinary can happen, and that's also part of the joy of being in such an orchestra, to feel that sense of unity, to feel when things are in flow and they're really clicking, when it's happening, and you find yourself playing better than you've ever played individually, better than you could play alone. So I talked a little bit about this role of the sheikh as conductor in the paragraphs preceding what we're going to reflect on tonight. Sufi principles and methods used in the orchestration of human transformation. This was published about 13 years ago. And it's intentionally sketchy, it's just to kind of give an overview, but I'll comment a little bit tonight. The first of these principles and methods is the remembrance of God under all circumstances. And remembrance implies two dimensions. One is a state of presence in which a person is whole and self-aware. And the second is a state of being in continual relationship with God, that is known, held, guided, and loved. So, this says a lot in a few words, because developing the state of presence is a lifetime's discipline, and presence is not just one thing or one state, it's something that a whole spectrum, or shall we say vertical ascension of states, that the human being moves through. Make sense? You know what I'm talking about? In other words, in the very beginning, presence is just paying attention, which is not necessarily easy to do under average circumstances. But as that attention deepens and we become more self-aware, as we become more more aware, more knowledgeable, more perceptive about our own state of being, our state of being also changes. And over time, the person who develops in presence, the quality of their being changes. And along with this, there's a kind of crossover point, where there's a point in presence in which it blends with or moves into your presence, experiencing your presence vis-a-vis the divine presence, or in relationship to the divine presence. Yourself, your own presence, as an experience within a greater presence, within an ocean of presence. And what happens there, you are known, you are held, you are guided, and you are loved within that presence. So there's some reciprocal thing going on. Ultimately, we could go further and we could say there's not really two, there never was two, there was only always one, but we don't need to go there now. We can just accept that you have a presence, I have a presence, and the more we can sustain that presence, the more we can deepen it, the more it will be flowing, intermingling with the greater ocean of being. So this is fundamental to everything we do, as I said, when we came in tonight. And the music of Tumata, that's the name of the group, was playing. We could come in and be busy with our own conditioning, our own stories, our own habits of mind, or we could empty and just fully enter the experience of being here. Two, worship. Understood as the integration of all one's faculties in the act of expressing love and respect to the Absolute. In its most specific sense, worship is a complete human action, including but not limited to ritual and ceremony, intended to harmonize ourselves with divine being. In its general sense, it is the purpose of our life on earth. One of our sheikhs, Hassan Shushud, said, "Our human egoism can create a world that is a mirage and a poison. The antidote is acts of worship." Our human egoism can create a world that is a mirage and a poison. The antidote is acts of worship. So I hope this gives some sense of both the importance of worship and a deepening of our understanding of it. And because it has been so limited, so reduced in many ways in conventional forms of religious practice. Yeah. Pass this to Tahir. But in those traditions in which the essence of worship is really alive, it is a comprehensive act of the human being involving mind, heart, intuition, and by intuition actually we have to include a whole range of spiritual subtle faculties, but also the body. More about that later. I mean, I'm sure it's reminding you of some aspects of our practice already. But ideally, an act of worship should involve every aspect of our humanness in a single, unified act of reverencing and being in relationship with the Absolute. How extraordinary it would be if we really, really knew how to do that and if we practiced that. And that is our practice, you know this. In order to do this kind of worship, of course, it presupposes some degree of development of presence and remembrance. The third aspect is submission. Now, there are lots of ways we could define submission, and by the way, these are just not meant to be dogmatic assertions, as much as suggestive phrasings of how we could understand these different principles. Submission, allowing the divine to be the center of our reality. The effective result of this submission is both self-transcendence and a capacity for sacrifice. Submission proceeds from the conditioned to the unconditioned, the compulsive self to the essential self, the finite to the infinite. By the way, if anybody has, if these words bewilder you or just totally confuse you, tell me. Say, I don't get this at all. What are you talking about? We won't mind. I'm packing, I tend to pack a lot into a few words. And there's experience behind this, there's metaphysics behind this, and there's an intention behind it. So, true submission is when we know that the divine reality is the master truth of existence, and we yearn, we desire, we're committed to keep it in the at the center of our consciousness. It doesn't mean that it precludes all the other things we have to do. Everything else is taking place around that center and within that context. But the human being who's in the constant state of submission is aware moment by moment on some level, not necessarily thinking, not making it a kind of explicit activity of thought, but a sense of the heart that we are living with in the divine, we depend on the divine, we trust the divine, and we wish to align ourselves with the goodness, the beauty, the generosity, the creativity, the intelligence of the divine. And little by little, our lives begin to take shape around that master truth. It doesn't happen like that. Submission is not just like, I don't think I'll submit now, you know, or something really challenging happens, and you say, please God, if you let me get through this, I promise I'll submit to you. No, it's a process of ripening. It's a process of maturing. It's a process of deepening love as well. So submission is both an initial step. In some ways it's one of the first steps, but it also has depth to it. It has levels to it. You know, we actually say there are three levels, and some of you know these already. The three in Arabic, the three words would be Islam, which is the preliminary submission, which is like, okay, I'm going to attempt to be in alignment with the divine. Then Iman, which is would be translated as faith or faithfulness, which is I'm really going to be faithful to this truth. It's a higher state than just the preliminary submission. And then finally, ihsan, which is a state of beautification, a state in which the beauty and goodness of the divine takes a person over so much that they naturally and spontaneously are doing what is appropriate, what is right, what is good, what is beautiful, as if they saw God in front of them in every moment and knew that they were, shall we say, within the consciousness of the divine. That's the highest state. So submission is both a first preliminary step and it's also, in some sense, a final step. Based on the idea of allowing the divine to be the center of our reality. Four, ethics, especially those straightforward and self-explanatory moral principles revealed in the Quran and other authentic revelations. Ethics apprehended by a loving heart contribute to a sense of harmony and trust through right relationships and sensitivity to appropriate boundaries. This is the Ten Commandments. This is the basic ethics of do no harm. Do not take what is not yours. And of course, this is another one of those areas where one's sensitivity also grows. I mean, there are what begins as just a basic conducting our lives in a moral way gets refined and refined and refined to the point where at other levels we really are questioning our livelihood, what we do to earn a living, what our sources of income are, what is the quality of our exchange in society, how much are we of service rather than being self-serving. So this is another area. All these areas, of course, have many levels of refinement and subtlety and development. And we have a lot of teachings in this field. Certainly for us, many of the hadith, and within the individual lineages of Sufism, there are also very specific teachings and examples and exemplars of people who have lived on such a high and beautiful level that we learn from those exemplars. Next, brotherhood, sisterhood, the bond consciously accepted by those who have undertaken a life's journey together. Brotherhood is the Sufi chivalry that acknowledges the centrality of love, interdependence, and heroic sacrifice. This one sentence or two sentences here, I would commend to you many incredible books. For instance, The Book of Sufi Chivalry by Al-Salami is an amazing compendium of principles of what's called futuwa, or Sufi chivalry, which actually was the basis for the chivalry that developed in the Middle Ages in Europe, much of which was drawn, if not all of which was drawn, from sources in the Middle East that the noblemen of Western Europe encountered during the Crusades. Book of Sufi Chivalry, Al-Ghazali's Principles of Brotherhood, another important book. And from time to time, we'll explore some of those teachings. It's just incredibly beautiful. But also, in terms of a group like this, I know we are young as a group and still very much in formation, just beginning to understand what this could mean. It has to be lived. The centrality of love, interdependence, and heroic sacrifice. Next, the art of spiritual conversation, which is also called soder, which is a part of every Thursday evening here. When minds join together and communicate for a spiritual purpose, an active receptivity is sustained. Energy is exchanged, and realization of meanings is deepened. The value and importance of soter, of spiritual conversation. I think all of these are such big subjects. There's a chapter on this in The Knowing Heart, and which just barely scratches the surface. But there is a real intentionality behind this process of sotet, which deepens over time, like all these others, which we are in the process of learning. And some of the Sufis would say it's really a kind of feast. The feast is put before us, or a feast comes down from higher realms. It's a feast of meaning. And when the actual energetic process of Sobet gets moving, it's a great pleasure. And it's not something one is easily, shall we say, satiated by. That's why from our experience and those in the lands of origin of Sufism, when a real sobet is happening, it can go on late into the night. It can go on for hours and hours. We tend to keep it quite within certain boundaries, but we have experienced for many years and various situations, the masters of Sopet, and we have stayed with them till dawn on some occasions and didn't regret it and didn't get bored. Reasoning, conscious reflection, lest we think that the mind is entirely abandoned. No, it's got an important role. Reason allows the intelligent ordering of ideas around the master truth of existence, the oneness of all being. Reason in this context is the working of the conscious intellect to decondition, recondition, and finally uncondition the whole of the mind, including the subconscious. We need deconditioning because inevitably we come from a world partly self-created, partly created by what the world is created by these days, which is greed, propaganda, mind control, worldliness, fear, imaginary fear, and an incredible chaos of wants and desires. That's what we come from. That's why we need deconditioning, gradually to sort these things out, to understand what is the appropriate measure of desire in a human being, what are the appropriate boundaries of our desire, how do we govern these things, how do we overcome fear, resentment, envy, pride, things like this. So there's a great wealth of teachings in this field That's just the deconditioning. The reconditioning is to be inspired by the beautiful virtues, the beautiful qualities of character that are possible for a human being that have been and that have been lived by our prophets, our saints, our spiritual masters. That's the reconditioning. We learn to reason with along these lines. We learn to reason with ourselves. It's a tool, partly for convincing the subconscious mind and bringing coherence at the subconscious level, because what first comes at the level of intellect and reasoning, one way or another, gets transferred to the subconscious mind. A lot has already been transferred there, whether you like it or not. A lot of disorder and inner conflicts have already been, you know, taken in by all of us. That's why we need the reconditioning. And finally, the unconditioning, which is a miraculous subject, which is what's possible after we have some clarity about the metaphysical principles, about the nature of reality, about the levels of reality, about what our spiritual anatomy is, what the soul is, what the spirit is, what the heart is. And we have, it sounds complex, but it's not, because it's such a coherent oneness. And once we have attained that to some extent, we can put it aside, and in a state of emptiness, in a state of open receptivity, move into the unconditioned experience of life and the divine. We can step outside the limitations of one aspect of the mind and open up to perception that is much wider and much more direct than reason alone. Reading sacred texts, the apprehension of the Word of God, and the inspired language of God's friends awakens the soul and purifies the heart. Again, just about every week that we come together, we share selections from Nalana, selections from sacred sources, like the Quran, and potentially like any of the great revelations that have come to humanity. And we have a great respect for the Word as a lens through which to perceive spiritual reality, especially the words that have been inspired from the highest sources, like Rumi's poetry, his Masnavi, and other great sources within our tradition and other traditions as well. Refining the subtle faculties of mind. The human heart is the doorway to the infinite mind of God. By developing our final faculties of perception, including dream work and intuitive perception, I could have added, could have gotten a lot more specific and added, named other forms of perception and spiritual intelligence, but let's just call it under the rubric of spiritual intelligence. These finer faculties, by developing our final faculties, veils are lifted and new dimensions of reality are revealed. Coming back to refining the subtle faculties of mind, what really underlies that principle and that statement is the fact that we have a whole range of subtle faculties of mind that function more and better when they're properly energized, when the heart is sufficiently purified, when the distortions of our egoism are removed. That's when these subtler faculties are functioning in a way that this reflects back to remembrance of God under all circumstances and many other things we've already touched on, but the refining the subtle faculties of mind will shed light on and reveal much about all of these other principles. Fasting. Just as the mind needs to be purified and refined to be able to make contact with the infinite, principles of purification and refinement need to be applied to the body in order that the veils of desire and compulsion may be lifted. If meditation is fasting of the mind, then fasting is meditation of the body. In other words, as in meditation, we empty the mind and open up to simple, pure perception or witnessing. When we experience fasting, removing the numbing process of taking in food, drink, we are purifying the body, subtilizing it, and this has and can have an extraordinary effect on all of our other faculties. Fasting is a part of every spiritual tradition. There are different ways to do it, and we certainly have our ways. Finally, movement and body work. The ritual prayer done 5 times a day is a complete yoga which maintains the health and equilibrium of the body. In addition, from the sublime whirling of the Mevlevis to the hadras or zikr circles of other orders that involve a vigorous bodily worship, Sufis have typically included the exercise of the body into their ceremonies. The ritual prayer has provided a grounded and dignified sobriety, and the zikr gatherings have allowed a degree of self-transcendence through the ecstasy of expansion. So bringing body into our worship, into our practice. Is almost completes the very comprehensiveness of the Sufi process. Just as the ritual prayer does, as worship does, the whirling, the movements of zikr. And I left out music. I didn't include music 12 or 13 years ago when I wrote this, but if I were writing it today, we would talk about music, because it's also opening a portal to the heavenly spheres, opening hearts to qualities and inspiration that are actually nourish the soul. But you already know that music is a big, beautiful part of the tradition. So the reason for going through this spectrum is just to acquaint us, reacquaint us with the wholeness of the spiritual process. That it is not what we have in a living tradition like Sufism. It's not just one technique that has been trademarked and has been absolutized and claimed to be the whole way of spiritual development. Such things exist. Such approaches exist. But in the living tradition of Sufism, there is a really broad, comprehensive array of practices, relationships, methodologies, and principles, each supporting each other, each illuminating each other. And to some extent, available as options for people to focus on. Some people focus on one approach more than another, perhaps, and yet there is this whole palette of practices and principles. There's a second section we won't read tonight called Qualities of a Spiritually Complete Human Being. I felt obliged to include something like that in the Knowing Heart because first of all, rather than enlightenment, in Sufism we talk about completion or maturity. Enlightenment is a very slippery subject. Not to say something like that doesn't exist, but we prefer to see it in the context of maturity and completion of the human being and the comprehensiveness of what's possible. Because for us, spirituality is the education of the whole human being. And not just a spiritual part, it's not just a specialization, it's not like in the whole process of life, there's all these things we could do, like cooking, and sports, and music, and sex, and business, and education, and spiritual. No, no, it's not one of those categories. It's all of those categories. It is the most comprehensive approach to human development, and that's how it's always been seen in our tradition. It's up to us to make it real and to live it as best we can. So, your thoughts, your questions, your observations.
I found it fascinating that in the first principle, when you talk about being in continual relationship with God, the verbs you use, known, held, guided, and loved, imply that in all cases, God is the actor the seeker is acted upon.
Great. Thank you for picking up on that. That's absolutely essential in our understanding. On the one hand, there is something that's expected of us. There is, you know, something we have to initiate and sustain. Initiate and sustain. And our practice is to sustain it. But as we practice to sustain it, we find that we are sustained in the process. It's been said, in particular, there are certain zikrs that can be given, for instance, that is forms of remembrance, especially some of those that have a very specific, say, pattern of breath. You begin by doing them, but after a while you find that that breath is doing you. So really, in this whole process, what happens, and one experiences this, we begin to feel that yes, there's something I need to do. I have a part in this. And at the same time, there are moments of being overwhelmed at how small that part is and how much agency or causality there is from the side of the infinite. And that's what allows submission. Right? So we talk about submission, and everybody, when approached from an egoistic point of view, submission seems like quite a chore. You're like, God, it's scary. Will I have to give up everything I love? And will I have to question every aspect of my ego and put every aspect of my being, you know, under observation and doubt? From the egoistic point of view, it looks like this. sometime. But there's another kind of experience where your selfhood melts like an ice cube in the sun and vaporizes and becomes humidity and problem solved. All the ice cube did was move into the sun, slide into the sun, get pushed into the sun. So what I'm trying to get at is just to offer you, offer us the big picture. And to always keep this in mind, to always have a sense both of the comprehensiveness of the teaching and practice, ultimately to live in that quality of being and in that relationship to reality in which we are conscious of being within that ocean of divine being. Yes, having an element of conscious will and choice in one sense, and in another sense seeing a greater pattern, seeing the agency of a grand and beautiful intelligence that's operating in everything. Sometimes I like to quote from Ibn Arabi, who gave a beautiful description of this when he said, "My journey, my spiritual journey, was entirely within myself. And when I came to the presence of my Lord, I saw that I was nothing but servanthood without a trace of sovereignty. I saw that I was purely a servant, and the sovereign was something else. But I only saw that when I came into union with that sovereign, when I came into union with my sustainer and Lord, in a journey that went right through my own being." So to me, this is just a beautifully subtle, comprehensive way of saying you are, in some sense, you are, you exist, you know, as a point of view, as servanthood, freely in that state of service. But your sovereign, the true power, the true agency, is with the infinite. So it's a delicious way of expressing that the two aspects of the reality. You know, I suppose it's a little bit like light. Is light a particle or a wave? You know, sometimes you're a particle, sometimes you're just a wave. It depends on how it's being observed. Thank you. Yeah. And that's why, for instance, in real worship, I mean, it's beautiful when the worship can involve some dynamic activity. Our whirling is an incredible example of that. Because in the whirling, to keep balance, you have to be empty. You can't be talking to yourself and keep that axis and keep that balance. You have to be empty. There's no fooling yourself about that. In order to be empty, you have to let something else take over. You have to be in relationship to something besides your own brain, your own mind, your own ego, to let that go. Likewise, in the ritual prayer, there's a way of doing it initially that is sort of self-conscious, self-possessed, even self-aware. And it's great because it is a unifying activity. But there are moments of such pure oblivion, which is not unconscious oblivion, but disappearing, when the worshipper becomes non-existent, and in becoming non-existent is one with all of existence. Or at least have a taste of that. Even a taste is delicious. And then you're grateful, and then you wish for more of that. You find the beauty in that, you find the pleasure in that, you find the gratitude in that. And actually, this silence is entirely appropriate, I hope. I hope it's a real silence. I hope it's a metaphysical silence and emptiness and not just a confusion of the mind that I've created. I hope we haven't done that. I hope we've just allowed ourselves just to, in relative silence of mind, enjoy just being. Just be. So when Rumi says, though a dozen earthenware jugs are lights, lamps, a dozen earthenware lamps, though separate in their bases, nevertheless their light is one. Now let me put this to you in the form of a question. And I thank you all for not over-intellectualizing this and realizing that that's not why we're here. But if I were to ask you a question that is meant to drive to the heart of your and core of your experience, if you were to ask yourself, from the whole of this picture that these words are trying to present, what would you take away from it? What would be the essence of it for you right now? What would you distill from all of this if you could put it all together into one perception? Not intellectualization, but one state of your heart. One realization, one taste, what would it be? Rebecca.
So now the entire day has led up until now. I am not the body. The body is in me.
Mm-hmm. Good. And the whole day has led up till now. Thank you. Under the qualities of a spiritually complete human being, there's one called being, which was described here as the capacity to remain in a state of presence, to contain experience. And that little phrase, to contain experience, is another way of saying what you just said. Mm-hmm.
Just as you said that, tears come up. Mm-hmm. There's a little edge of something wet. Mm-hmm. How it gathers. Mm-hmm.
I had a delightful discovery last night. I went on Facebook, and I haven't been there for months, and I found a message from a musician named Baraka Blue. Has anybody heard of Baraka Blue? He's like a kind of a world famous Muslim hip hop artist, and lots of people had recommended him to me, and so he's sending me a message. He's saying, I want you to listen to this song that I wrote after reading your book, The Knowing Heart, especially the chapter on Love's Universe. And the song is called Hidden Treasure. So it linked to this like music service that a lot of big stars use, where you could listen to his music. And he had this song. It was very nice. I mean, it was really very tasteful. He's a very tasteful, mellow hip-hop sort of guy. And normally I don't care for hip-hop too much, but this is very gentle, beautiful, serene, mystical. And the song is Hidden Treasure. And he said initially when reading the chapter, he had written like 10 pages of lyrics from that one chapter. But then he had to refine it down to just what would fit in a song that's maybe 8 minutes long. But one of the lines that was repeated was, you are the drop that contains the ocean, which you took from that chapter, which of course I took from Eunice Emre, and it's all borrowed, you know. And but he did this wonderful song called The Hidden Treasure, and the hidden treasure being that dimensionless point within our own being, which is absolutely infinite and contains everything. And I was just thrilled to find somebody, an artist, taking something like this and doing something spiritually creative with it. So sometime if you're interested in that, you can do a search. Baraka Blue, B-A-R-A-K-A, Blue, and Hidden Treasure. Hear his song. And then on the website he had actually quite a whole like little story about how the song was, which is really nice. So the knowing heart is becoming music. Just as your day led up to this moment. And that's how it is. I mean, even what you say, Rebecca, describes the unfolding of an intelligent, creative process that has its own meaning, has its own shape, has its own kind of intentionality to it. This is how life takes on meaning, meaning not in a mental sense, but meaning in a heart sense, which causes the ice cube to melt a little bit. Not that you're an ice cube. You're never an ice cube. Maybe, I don't know. I can't think of quite the right melting metaphor for Rebecca. What, did I miss something?
I said chocolate frost.
I thought of chocolate, but I didn't want to say it.
Cream cheese frost. Yeah.
Butter, no, not quite.
No, no.
Chocolate.
Chocolate cream cheese.
Great Sufi saint said, those who are near to God, those who are the friends of God, are divers for pearls and got in the ocean of God's unity. And they are from head to toe evidence of the divine reality. It's been actually an amazing few days recently. There was this saying of the prophets that I had written down 25 years ago, and I didn't know the source of it, and I could never verify whether it was an authentic saying of the prophet or not, but I held on to it. And once when we went to Turkey, I even asked everybody on the trip, 25 or so people, to memorize this hadith, and people loved it.
And on Umrah in Damascus.
Oh, Umrah? Is that where we did?
It was Umrah. Okay. In Damascus, we recited it at Ibn Arabi.
Ibn Arabi prayer? I'm not talking about the Ibn Arabi prayer, I'm talking about the Hadith.
Yeah.
In any case.
Yeah.
And just about 10 days ago, Aisha Henry came over and gave us a book. The book is called Reassurance of the Seeker. And it's a book about hadith, and from a great Egyptian alim, a contemporary who died, you know, in recent decades. And in the back of this book was an appendix called the Hadith of the Prophet's Sunnah, the Hadith of the Prophet's Way. And there it was in the appendix, that very hadith, complete with Arabic, which I've been seeking, because I was troubled by some of the translation. I was just uncertain about it. And I really needed to know the Arabic to be able to translate it accurately. And there it was, and I found this hadith, and I was thrilled, and I took it with me to Georgia. We spoke about it at a couple of events in Georgia. And we will look at it next week. But I want to finish telling the story, because today I sent it to Aisha and I said, recently I found the Arabic for the Hadith of Muhammad's Sunnah that I've been looking for over 20 years. This gave me the opportunity to translate it with awareness of the original vocabulary. Thank you for publishing this. And then this afternoon I got an email from a name I didn't recognize. And had no idea who this person was. I got two emails suddenly, and both of them were very long, and one of them is going into great detail about this hadith, explaining all the variations of it, and who had different versions of it, and how it came, you know, how she came to know about it and everything. And then she also said, and this was the woman who had translated the book by this Egyptian scholar, saint. This is the woman, I don't know what country she's from or even who she is, she has a foreign name. And she said, I grew up in Islam and I had no interest in it and no knowledge of mystical, of the Sufi path, until I read Women of Sufism and Living Presence. and this brought me to the path. And she's now become a great scholar and translated this whole book in this hadith. Would you like to hear the hadith I was making such a fuss about? It has been narrated that our master, Hazrati Ali, said, "I asked the messenger of God about his sunnah," means his path, his example. Now the context of this is that fundamentalists and some extremists have turned the sunnah of the Prophet into a purely outward behavioral set of regulations, rules, prescriptions, etc. They've really externalized the whole thing. very little basis for doing that, because I've always said and believe that the Prophet's sunnah, that his way was flexibility and preference for essence over form. And the way he lived, the way he taught, the way he solved people's problems really makes this very clear. And this hadith, in which Imam Ali, who is like the one of the most beloved companions of Muhammad and the origin of Sufism, in the chain of Sufism, it goes right through Ali back to Muhammad. So Ali asks the Prophet, "What is your sunnah?" And here's what the Prophet says. "Gnosis, or spiritual perception, is my stock in trade. Intellect is the basis of my religion. Love is my foundation. Longing or yearning is my vehicle. Remembrance of God is my comfort. Trust is my treasure. Sorrow is my companion and friend. Knowledge is my weapon. Patience is my provision. Contentment is my wealth. Powerlessness is my pride. Detachment is my trade." The word for detachment there really means doing without. I couldn't find quite the right word. It's zuhd in Arabic. Not asceticism, but, you know, that kind of detachment. "Certainty is my strength. Truthfulness is my remedy. Obedience is my honor. Struggle is my character. My pleasure is in worship. My concern is for my community. And my longing is for my sustainer." So, next week we'll look at least at some of this. And I want to begin right at the very beginning with "Gnosis is my stock in trade." That's where he begins. Why we love mom. Among the prophets. Among our love for all the prophets. Inshallah. Enough. So, I also had the feeling, and I hope you had it too, when we came and we sat together and we open up to our own inner being, we open up to the presence of our own heart, and we feel, and maybe we experience a little bit, what a beautiful thing it is to have a heart. What an extraordinary thing to have a heart and to feel for a moment some purity in the heart. We may not feel that way always, but we have a moment of that experience, and we have a moment in which we feel that this equipment, this for perception that we've been given, this instrument of relationship, which is the heart, this knowingness, which is the soul, what a gift, what a joy. Thank you. Mo, would you bring out the training board? Welcome back. Natasha has just returned from Russia. Happy to have you home.